Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today as we begin the show by talking with you about water, clean water. Our guest today has decades of water and environmental expertise. He's Dan Benna, a globally recognized water steward. He's an award-winning consumer products executive, a writer and speaker. He led the sustainable development agenda for PepsiCo's global operations. So he has a global perspective, certainly, on this. And it's great to have him with us. And you can join in the conversation as well. I hope you'll give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Maybe you're involved in clean water initiatives. You can talk about them. What questions do you have? Again, 1-800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. And Dan Benna, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Harry, Larry, thanks so much for having me. I've heard great things about you, and I'm excited to be here.
Well, you describe yourself as a water steward. Talk about what that means, what that is.
You know, Larry, I kind of came to that sort of as an evolution, because I started with PepsiCo, oh my God, far too many years ago than I like to remember, in 1984. And I was a laboratory technician, didn't know a whole lot about water. And then the CEO at the time needed someone to kind of take on the mantle of becoming a water subject matter expert. And I was identified. So I was very much involved with designing water treatment systems for PepsiCo's global beverage plants, because every single plant in the world treats the water before it goes into a beverage. But that was very much kind of scientific based. It was treatment technology. It was looking at raw water characteristics and figuring out how to remove the contaminants. But then I always say that the proverbial spark lit, and I never quite knew what that was, when people would say, oh, you know, once the spark gets lit and you become passionate, it can be life-changing. Well, Larry, the spark lit for me when I started to be asked questions about the global water crisis, and it really shifted me from being very scientifically focused on treatment design to looking at the world through a much broader lens. And I'd say that's when I really started to understand stewardship. I think in the simplest terms, Larry, if you value something, you can be a good steward. So kind of valuation is the very first step. We used to say at PepsiCo, if you treasure it, you'll measure it. So, I mean, it sounds kind of simple, but there's a lot of truth in that. So being a good water steward just means that you value water as a resource, as a shared resource, and you're not the only one, and your family is not the only ones that are using it. In fact, the entire population obviously is using it. And then taking actions both locally and globally through advocacy to really try to improve the crisis of water insecurity. And it's a significant crisis, Larry. I mean, it's addressed by the UN Sustainable Development Goals. There's an explicit goal, number 6, about water. And, you know, there are issues with all sorts of things around it.
What areas of the world have poor access to clean water?
Well, you know, that's a complicated question, Larry, because you use two words that are important to kind of peel away. One is access and one is clean water. And access kind of implies water scarcity. So you want to make sure that there is enough water around as a resource, right, at the very resource level, whether it's a surface supply or a groundwater supply like a well. And it kind of varies by season, but the areas of the world that are the most challenged in terms of water scarcity are largely Asia and Latin America. But I say that with the caveat that when you look on a very local level, virtually every country in the world at one time or another has addressed water scarcity or is trying to address water scarcity. Even the U.S., right? When you look at the horrible droughts that have occurred historically in California and in the southeast and southwestern U.S., it's just horrific. So that's kind of an access question. But when you talk about safe water, that's another really interesting question, Larry, because if you talk to the U.N., they'll give you a statistic that says about 785 million people lack basic drinking water service. And basic drinking water service doesn't really mean safe. It just means that you can go get water from a well or from a reasonably safe source less than about a 30-minute walk from where you live. Now, I don't think anyone in the U.S. would define that as kind of safe water, but that's one of the definitions of the U.N. So that's 785 million. If you look, though, Larry, at, you know, safe water, clean water, meaning I can go to a tap sustainably and safely and reliably, turn it on and get clean water, about 2.2 billion people in the world don't have that luxury. And unfortunately, that too is very much in Asia. Africa is suffering horrific, abject lack of access to safe drinking water. Certainly rural parts of Latin America are horrible. And honestly, Larry, people always look at this as kind of a quote-unquote third world problem, and they never look inside the U.S. But unfortunately, when we look at things like what happened in Flint, Michigan, what happened in Detroit, what happened in Newark, New Jersey, it really has started to open our eyes to the fact that this is truly a global problem.
Man, it's when you cite those numbers, it's almost unbelievable that that many people don't have access to clean water. We're so lucky here. I mean, in Wisconsin right now, people probably will complain about too much water, and with the climate change and everything else, we've had a lot of flooding, and there's water everywhere, it feels like, in this state.
So, you know, Larry, you bring up a great point. And when I speak to, I do a lot of speaking, particularly to school children. I call them children only because I feel old when I go into colleges and universities, to young adults around the world. And I try to simplify things as much as I can, because like with most things, Larry, this can get really complicated really quickly. And then you tend to lose people. But the bottom line is there's three issues globally. There's either too little water, or it's not in the right places at the right times. There's either too much water, which is exactly what you said, but the problem with that is we don't have the programs to be able to precisely predict when those huge, you know, water events, those floods are going to happen with enough time to actually react to them in advance. So it's too little or in the wrong places, too much or at the wrong times or unable to predict. And obviously the last one is just too poor a quality, because water pollution is absolutely a scourge that's been worsening.
Let's talk about some of the ways that you may have been involved in or know about where there have been efforts to address some of these issues around the world.
Larry, this is my baby, as I say, and I this is what gets me out of bed every morning, because as dire as some of these statistics sound, there really is tremendous hope. And there really, I mean, if you were to Google, you know, not-for-profits doing things with safe water, you would get pages and pages and pages of results back. And when I was at PepsiCo, and I have to say, I'm no longer with PepsiCo, so the law department likes me to say that anything I say about PepsiCo is my own opinion and is not representative of PepsiCo. So I had to get that out. But, you know, when you're with an organization for 34 years, it's kind of tough not to talk about PepsiCo. So I'm really proud on a personal and a professional level, because our CEO at the time, Indra Nooyi, was so supportive of what I call the water portfolio of partners. And she supported us because she came from an area of India that actually grapples with water issues every single day. And she remembers as a child waiting for water trucks literally to deliver water. And now, you know, when she became the CEO of a $65 billion company, she said, I need to do something about this. So she supported me and others and many colleagues in forming this kind of portfolio of partnerships. And one of the partners it's called the Safe Water Network. There's an actor, Paul Newman, who I know you all know. Unfortunately, a lot of the younger generation might not, but he was really an iconic movie and television actor. And he started a charity called the Safe Water Network because he wanted to make the provision of safe water, one of his legacy commitments. And I'm so fortunate not only to have brung the Safe Water Network to PepsiCo as a founding partner, but now I actually am a senior advisor for them. So when I left PepsiCo, they came to me and said, would you like to consult? I said, absolutely. But Larry, they're doing something that's really pretty different, and I think it's worth noting, because a lot of organizations will try to address this with philanthropy, really kind of pure philanthropic dollars, writing checks and hoping that you'll be able to use that money to go into a community and dig a well. Unfortunately, about 50% of those kinds of safe water projects that are only kind of financial support fail within 5 years. So you're kind of throwing good money after bad, unfortunately. What Safe Water Network has done is they've spent the last 12 years optimizing a model. It's called the Small Water Enterprise, which is a locally owned water business that we get entrepreneurs to kind of start up in communities. And it's moving toward financial sustainability for the provision of water. And that's something that's really exciting, because instead of this huge infrastructure, which is the way it's always been done, where, you know, you actually build miles and miles of pipe and it costs a lot of money to maintain it, they're building very small decentralized systems that serve individual communities or clusters of communities. And so far, they've managed to get water to 1.5 million people in about 350 communities. So I really think this is going to be the way of the future.
Man, that's great news. But there's a lot more communities out there that need that help.
There are. And thank God for organizations like the UN, Larry. You know, they have been criticized, surely, over the years for many things. But one of the things I think was their crowning glory was the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. And I kind of mentioned them in passing, and I'm sure many of your listeners have probably heard about them, at least in passing. But it's a series of 17 goals and 169 targets that every single member state of the UN agreed to in 2015. Now, you're talking about 193 countries thought enough of the Sustainable Development Goals to say, yep, we agree with them, and we're going to ratify them. And in my lifetime, Larry, I don't know when the UN, you know, 193 countries have agreed on anything. So for them to do that right away says, I better stand up and take notice. And they're really starting to engage people, not just at this kind of high-level UN way, but they're really making it an inclusive process. And they're engaging all sorts of stakeholders around the world. I mean, individuals can participate. Companies can participate. Not-for-profits can participate. So I really think that, you know, for people to support the SDGs or at least learn about them is one of the ways that we're going to move this needle in the right direction.
Yeah. Dan Benna, our guest today, a globally recognized water steward, as we visit with him about water stewardship. Questions or comments, you can give a call at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Here we've got the 50th anniversary of Earth Day coming up next week, Dan. As a fact, a week from today, as a matter of fact. What are your thoughts on where we've been over the last 50 years?
Well, you know, Earth Day, I'm sure, is very special to the people of Wisconsin because of, you know, its founder, essentially, was a senator from Wisconsin right back in 1970. Unfortunately, I was only 8 years old when the first Earth Day happened, but I have heard from one of my older sisters, who is a very strong activist, and I call her my hippie sister because she grew up in the hippie generation. Earth Day was really important to her. And, you know, she kind of started, whether I realized it or not at the time, just by kind of mentors. And those are mentors that are family members, mentors in the workplace. Just by talking about things and raising awareness of things, you start to assimilate stuff, right? So I think that's part of what formed my early social conscience, was just hearing it. And, Larry, I think that's really one of the values of having a day, whether it's Earth Day or World Water Day, or, you know, if you go to the UN calendar, there's virtually a day for every single day on the calendar. And it helps focus people's attention. and educate them and build awareness and, frankly, run campaigns that are targeted so that it gets people excited and it gets some buzz going. So I think, you know, I think the fact that Earth Day exists is great. I think many of these days really need support. But the real challenge is not making it just a snapshot in time and making sure that all of the positive energy and the momentum that starts on Earth Day or whenever just continues and it becomes kind of a normal way of life. I think that's the real challenge. But, you know, as I look, and I'm a glass half full optimist, my sisters always actually criticize me and say sometimes I'm actually too optimistic when they look at the intractable challenges that we face in the world. But I say to them, if I don't think that there are solutions to them, I would find it really difficult to get out of bed every morning. So I think, you know, on balance, if I look from the 70s, 80s, 90s to today, there really has been tremendous progress that's made.
We will take some calls. If you'd like to join in, number to call 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions and comments. Marcus in Milwaukee, I believe, is with us with a question. Marcus?
Hi, Larry. How are you?
Good. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
So my question is, what can we all do to deal with the microplastics in the water that we all face around the world?
Marcus, thanks for that question. And yep, absolutely. It's a great question. There's about 8 million tons of plastic that enters the oceans every year. There's at least one estimate that says by 2050, there will be more plastic than fish in the oceans, which is just an abysmal statistic. And Marcus, you specifically mentioned microplastic, and I'm going to add to that and say there's even one step further, which are nanoplastics and nanoplastic particles. And Larry, for those of your listeners that don't know, that just relates to the size of the particles as they degrade. So microplastics are typically larger particles, and then nanoplastics are even much smaller than that. And unfortunately, they're finding that nanoplastic particles are, in fact, being incorporated into the muscles of fish and other marine life. You've heard about the Pacific gyres and other gyres that have formed these basically garbage patches of plastic. It's unbelievably unfortunate. And Marcus, the best thing to do, I'm a huge fan of consumerism and consumer-based advocacy. And I can tell you, when I was at PepsiCo, one of the largest consumer products companies, because 1.2 billion people every single day eat or drink a Pepsi product. Let me tell you, companies listen to consumers. And when you can band together as consumers and start to make purchasing decisions based on what companies do, they stand up and take note. And I mean, I can tell you, I've never seen a flurry of activity to help this plastic scourge as I've seen in the last 2 years. I mean, it's almost as though it was under the radar for a while. And certainly academics knew a lot about it, and they were trying to sound the alarm, but it was falling on deaf ears. But now, all of a sudden, a lot more people in the general population are aware of it. So, you know, it's things like reducing plastic, it's recycling plastics, it's making sure that companies move toward as much recycled content as possible, and when possible, actually move out of plastics, because you know, it's going to be a continuing scourge unless that kind of transformation happens.
Marcus, thank you very much for calling. Ron in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Ron.
Thank you. Several months ago, I heard someone who studies the Mississippi River Basin, the whole billions of acres, millions of square miles, that in recent years, the basin as a whole has gotten 3 more inches of rain than it had historically just a few decades ago. And that is part of the reason that the Mississippi River has remained in flood stage for weeks and months at a time. Okay, there are two things I want to suggest. The Small Watershed Project is a federal law decades and decades old called PL-566. We have to convince the politicians in Washington to fund that, to rehabilitate the dams which have been washed out. The spillways were washed out earlier this century in Vernon County, for example, in Wisconsin. And we must redesign them all to handle the new normal. Next year, the National Weather Service should publish maps and charts based on the 91 through 2020 rainfall records. Okay, the other main topic is rain gardens, infiltration trenches, and basins. These are things that every homeowner, possibly even renters, every farmstead should be using to catch the water that gushes off their roofs and driveways and parking areas, hold it on their land, force it to recharge the groundwater in their immediate area. Here in Dane County, there are places we've sucked the water table down more than 100 feet because of all the water we've pumped out in the last two centuries.
Well, we're running a little short on time, Ron. I thank you for calling. Dan, comments?
Yeah, Larry, so Ron is obviously really hyper-local with those comments, so I'm not familiar with that specific law, that regulation that he mentioned. What I can tell you is I absolutely agree that there needs to be a full-scale revamping and reset of how we look at water-related regulations in the U.S. Let me give you an example. The American Society for Civil Engineers in 2017 gave the U.S. drinking water infrastructure a grade of D. D as in David. Mm. Now, that's pretty sad, right? We're talking about the U.S., yeah. And it got a D grade, and it's not the first time it got a D. In fact, it's gotten that for several times since they've been marking it. But we're talking about a million miles of pipe just in the U.S. alone, and there's about 240,000 water main breaks a year. Now, what does that relate to? 2 trillion gallons of treated drinking water that's being wasted. So, I mean, I couldn't agree more with Ron when he says we need to look at this at the federal and the state level with respect to infrastructure, but take a systems approach. It's not just drinking water infrastructure. It's wastewater infrastructure. It's sewers. It's what farmers are doing. And the one thing I would caution, while I agree absolutely that rainwater catchment and harvesting is a great idea, there are some states that actually don't allow that by law. Because the idea is that if you're capturing it, you're artificially kind of interfering with the normal recharge of water to a basin. So just be careful if you're going to do that.
Yeah. Dan, and what can we do as individuals in our last minute?
Larry, I'm willing to send this link to you because maybe that's the best way. But there's this thing called The Lazy Person's Guide to Saving the World. And if people Google it, it's something that the UN put out. It's only 2 pages, but it has literally something for everybody. If they call it a couch potato approach, which is the simplest thing, all the way up to advocating large-scale change. But you're talking about real basics, Larry. Turn the water off when you're brushing your teeth. Run your dishwasher fewer times, only when there's full load. Take shorter showers. The bottom line comes full circle back to what I started with. Value the water that we have. When South Africa reached that day zero, they limited people to 13 gallons a day of drinking water. The average U.S. person uses about 100 gallons a day. So there's a lot of leeway there, Larry, for us to improve.
Dan, I hope we have a chance to talk again. Thank you so much for being with us today. Dan Benna, globally recognized Water Steward Award-winning consumer products executive and writer and speaker. Great to have him with us. We'll have him back. Coming up next, we'll talk Earth Day. I'm Larry Mueller.